Welcome to Olympics coverage on the Lion's Den. On today's episode, we speak to Henry Fieldman, the bronze medal winning cox of the men's eight and a former Hamiltonian.
Delighted to say I'm joined now by Henry Fieldman, who is the cox for the GB men's eight. And rowing fans among you will know that he just won a bronze medal in Tokyo, and he's back in the UK now. And I'm delighted to say that he is joining us to talk about his success. Henry, first of all, congratulations. That must have been a pretty good feeling standing up on the podium last week.
Oh, thanks very much. Yeah, it was definitely a special moment. Dreamed of going to the Olympics since I started rowing. So to go there and to be lucky enough to get on the podium was definitely a special moment.
So you medaled with GB at European level, world level, now obviously at the pinnacle at the Olympics. You're back home in the UK now. Has it quite sunk in, or is it just, you know, with hectic traveling across the world during a pandemic, etc., does it feel a little bit anticlimactic, or is it just as special as you expected this moment to be?
If I'm honest, I haven't really had a moment to stop and take stock, I guess. I took my medal to see my mum and dad as soon as I could. And from then on, I've just kind of been pulled in every direction, like friends and family just wanting to come. And it's absolutely great to see them all. I kind of was just thinking, I really need to just take a moment to just sit down and in silence, just think about it a bit. But it has been really, I've missed being in the UK and seeing friends and family. But we've been away for, haven't been in my own bed for maybe 2 months now. So just with all the traveling. So it's really nice to be back. It hasn't quite sunk in, but I'm working on it.
Talk me through that travel process, because, you know, we've seen reports of various holding camps and quarantine requirements going into Tokyo, etc. I know you're okay. You were saying you're double vaxxed there, so coming into the UK was relatively easy, but talk us through the process of getting to Tokyo and all that travel. And obviously that was a bit different to regattas that you might be used to.
Yeah, definitely. I've lost count of the number of COVID tests we did, but it was a lot. So we let's see, we started our kind of pre-games training camp in we went off to Italy for 2 weeks, and then went off to our high altitude camp in Silvretta in Austria for another 2 weeks. From then we came back to the UK for what they're calling a holding camp. So where we just basically had COVID tests each day. And then I think if we were all good, then we got to go to Japan. Then into Japan, spent maybe 5 or 6 days outside the village in a hotel, training at a nearby university, and then finally into the village. And then once you're in there, still COVID tests every day. They do it a bit differently in Japan. We had a sort of test tube we had to spit into. Very strange. Quite nice on the nose. Nice to get a bit of a break. but yeah, there was a few unexplained kind of mysteries about that. When we first got into the airport in Tokyo, they put us into this little booth where we spit into this tube, and there's just pictures of lemons around. I don't know if that's meant to help you salivate. I'm not sure. Very strange. Never got to the bottom of it. But all in all, it was a lot of COVID tests and a lot of mitigations, I guess.
Yeah, I wonder how many athletes were salivating over lemons as they arrived into Tokyo. And talk to me about the village itself and what that was like. Were you relatively free to move around within the village, or even outside, or, you know, what was Tokyo like? Because, you know, paying attention to the games and seeing what various journalists were saying, it seemed very strange. Like Tokyo, there was no branding around the city. You know, if you weren't there for the Olympics or going to the events, apparently it would have been quite easy to miss the fact that they were going on.
Really? Wow. Yeah. So we didn't get to go out of, we were just confined to the competition venue and the village itself. Within those two areas, we were able to move around quite freely. But you were encouraged to, and, you know, you wanted to anyway, to kind of keep yourself to yourself a little bit. You know, only really mix with your team and your immediate team, I guess, and I suppose your boat. The village was, I think, like ahead of time when we went to the village and we went to Tokyo even, people were saying, you know, make sure you take in the environment because it's special, take in the moment. But it sort of trying to marry that up with like you're there to do a job and do a job that's like quite difficult was an interesting one to try and balance. But it was really special being in the village. It was a beautiful, Team GB had a block that just basically looked out onto Tokyo Bay. I was lucky enough to have a room on the side of the block that really did look out. It was just gorgeous waking up to that every day. And then, because I'm the cox, so I've got to watch my weight a little bit. So sometimes that involves a little jog in the evening. And I actually was in an apartment with my coach, who was always quite keen that I went for a jog in the evening. And sometimes we did that together. And it was cool just running around and kind of seeing all the other nations out there, just either relaxing or doing their own training. And all different things, like we're running around this path, and this boxes, sparring with each other. And you're kind of thinking, like all the sort of challenges and the story that you've sort of brought personally to get to that point. And then you look around you and there's so many other people that have all got an interest, a similar or different, but a challenging story, a challenging history that's got them there. And you kind of feel like, even though you're all there with different national kit on, competing for your country, there's actually so much in common you have with these people. Maybe it's unspoken, but you kind of feel like it's there, and I think that felt pretty special.
Yeah, it's almost like a competitive solidarity, isn't it?
Absolutely.
I guess you must have been quite lucky, the nature of your event. There's nine of you, eight rowers and you, so you had quite a few people to mix with, I suppose, away from the boat, whereas I suppose maybe individual athletes might not have been so lucky given all the restrictions. You mentioned there trying to take in the experience maybe away from the boat a little bit more. I know quite a lot of athletes have been trying to make up for the lack of fans by going to watch maybe some other events. Did you do any of that, or was it sole focus on what you guys were up to?
So we personally weren't able to go and look at any other events. There were times like if there was a competitive, I guess if competition was going on a day when you were in the venue, you could see a little bit of that. So I got into the stands to see our spares race, which was really cool, but I mean I was one of like 10 people. we had the TV, so we could see other events that way, but no, I would have really loved to some sports I'd have loved to have seen live, like in the flesh, but I think my overriding feeling was that I was just grateful that we were even there. I was so fearful maybe in the year running up that it would just not happen. So I was, much as, you know, you always want more, and I'd love to have experienced other sports there, I was generally just grateful that it was happening.
Were you involved in the preparations before it all got called off last year?
Yeah, so we were, it was quite dramatic almost. We were at Caversham, which is our training base near Reading, and it was an awful day. And it was meant to be a day of trials, but the weather was so bad that they decided to call off the trials and just announce the team. So we're kind of standing outside the building, and because of the pandemic, we had to be outside the building because it just kind of kicked off that was the regulation. So we're standing out there in the wind and the rain, and they're announcing the team. And then we're told to go home. And then a week later, the games was cancelled completely. So it was a real roller coaster back in 2020. So yeah, I was very much involved at the time. And with the group, the boat changed by one person from 2020 to 2021. We all kind of I guess it was a shared experience through there.
Well, I think that's enough COVID talk. I mean, it's kind of obligatory, isn't it? But because you have to try and figure out what the experience is like and how it differs from normal. But at the same time, everybody's sick of talking about it. Let's talk about the race itself. I mean, before the race, you guys probably didn't have the most straightforward pathway in terms of you to go through the repechage. So, I mean, for those of us who aren't maybe necessarily as familiar with regattas, and you know, those of us who become rowing experts every 4 years, or in this case, 5 years, is that normally done to medal after having to go through the repechage system?
It certainly has been done. I think, so our coach, Steve Trapmore, he stroked the GB8 back in 2000 and they won the Olympic Games, went through the repechage. I think for us, yeah, it was a really challenging path through the regatta to get to that point. I think maybe after the heat, you'd probably say we were the fifth fastest crew in the event. After the Repechage, we were maybe the fourth fastest crew in the event. And then by the final, luckily third. But I think so we came in as the top seed. We'd had a really good season, won every race rolling into it. So it was a challenging moment, kind of having such an uncompetitive race in the opening round and then having to go through the Repechage. But I think we can be pleased that we managed to build well through the event. But we would have liked a slightly more straightforward path for sure.
And then, so you say there, top seed before the regatta, then fifth seed after one race, fourth seed after another, you know, sitting on the starting line with all that in mind, did your expectations and your goals change as the races went on, as you kind of saw where you guys lay in the pecking order, so to speak?
I think, it's funny, like in rowing, because it's so, you're just in your own lane. It's non-contact. You're sort of, I guess your goal is always to go as fast as you can. And maybe your expectation is like slightly more emotional. There's a bit more of an emotional attachment. I think we always were trying to win. And I think we really felt that we'd sort of come back through the heat and the Repechage, we'd come back to an understanding of what gets the most out of us. So I think we went in with a lot more confidence into the final than maybe we had in the Repechage. Aim was absolutely to win, but by that point we'd lost to the Kiwis twice in a week, so we knew it was going to be a challenge. And unfortunately, we weren't quite able to overcome them. But hats off, they did a really great job. So I think our goal was always the same, despite the week we'd had. But perhaps our expectations kind of moved around a little bit.
Yeah, just to quickly dot the I's and cross the T's there. You mentioned there the Kiwis, they won gold, Germany won silver, obviously you guys won bronze. It was a fantastic race. I really encourage, there's a great little video on BBC YouTube channel, if anyone missed it, of the last 500 meters. And James Cracknell on BBC commentary is going absolutely mental because you guys were in the silver position at the last 500. And then it was a really, really exciting, you know, neck and neck finish. You said there that the goal was always to win it, but, you know, maybe having lost twice to the Kiwis, expectations change. I'm curious as to your insight here, because there's been a real attitude shift, it seems like, in these games towards what success looks like. And so many athletes have come out and said too many countries place maybe a too great an evidence emphasis rather on gold or nothing. And another former Cambridge rower, Kath Bishop, has been very vocal in her on social media talking about how you take success, et cetera. And I'm wondering if that has maybe had any effect in the GB rowing squad, and that, you know, a bronze medal is still a fantastic achievement. And maybe even though you might have wanted to win gold at the beginning, you're still able to come away from that and be incredibly proud of what you've achieved.
Yeah, I think it's something that I haven't really thought through enough to give an answer that I'm confident in. I think it's a real mixed feeling. Absolutely you want to win, that was always the goal, but you know, to get a medal is great. I was having a chat with an old friend this morning about the medal kind of thing, and the medal is just like an object, and it represents, even though it's bronze, it represents a lot of sacrifice and hard work and determination and learning and I guess support and from people around you, and that's really nice to have an object that represents that thing, but it doesn't mean, whether you have the object or you don't, it doesn't mean that, you know, those things existed or they didn't. They were absolutely there, and I think probably the key things that I'll take away from the games were experience of competing at that level and seeing how I react in that kind of fierce competition environment, seeing how my teammates react, and then kind of moving forward with that, I feel more well furnished to deal with that situation in maybe a better way. Not that we dealt with it in a bad way, but I think, you know, there are always things with hindsight that you think you could have done better, and whether it's rowing or whether it's anything else, I feel like those things are really valuable, and we take those forward. But you know, obviously you want a medal and you want a gold one. So I think I feel really, really pleased that we've got those lessons, we've had those experiences, and we do have a medal. But you know, you always want to be the best in the world at that time. And I think a lot of us will be coming back and trying to do that, but we'll be in a better position to do that having gone through this this last week.
Yeah, it feels like the experiences from a personal point of view are always going to be there no matter what. You know, if you didn't qualify for the final, you'd still have those experiences, but it seems like it's quite nice to have that, some sort of external physical representation of that, to show, well, not necessarily to show to yourself, but to show to others that, you know, you've gone through something and you've achieved a lot.
Absolutely. It's I think one of the nicest things has been coming back to see my, like, I guess when I got to the airport and my mom was like picking me up, which is kind of sweet. I just hung the medal over her head and she loved that. And then, you know, you kind of see friends and family, they want to hold it and they want to wear it and get a photo. And it's really nice to see, to have that moment. But it's not the most important thing. I think the most important thing is, you know, what we've learned as a collective and how we can be better as humans and competitors moving forward. I think that's the key bit. But it is always nice to have those moments with a bit of metal as well.
Of course. And then bearing in mind with those experiences, I think you briefly mentioned it a second ago, but of course Paris is only in three years' time rather than the usual four. Is that the next step? Obviously there's Worlds and Europeans between them, but in terms of overriding goals, is that next on the horizon?
Yeah, I think it's we haven't had a break for so long now that I think there'll probably a lot of people will want to just let the dust settle a little bit and have a good think. But I think most of us in the eight are already pretty motivated to try and go one or two better, and it's only 3 years away, so I think yeah, it probably is the next step. But then I guess from a wider, I guess, you know, you want to, that's the outcome you want, but yeah, we should probably want to, you know, get better at doing the process, get better at managing ourselves through the event, this, that, and the other. But yeah, I think it's definitely something that you probably don't want to be thinking about right now, but I think we probably all are thinking about it.
Yeah, you guys are competitors at the end of the day. You can't shy away from that, I suppose. Let's take a step back then, away from, you know, the emotional high that was Tokyo. And let's chat a bit more about your Cambridge connection. Why don't you just, you know, tell us when you were a Cambridge student and what you did?
Yeah, sure. So I was a student back in 2013. I did the MPhil in psychology and education. I was at Homerton. I had a fantastic time at Cambridge. I'd come from Imperial College where I did my undergrad, and it was somewhere where I just felt everywhere around, like I loved walking through town and just seeing people, whatever they were trying to do, they were trying to do something really, really well. And there was a real kind of buzz and energy about the place. And I loved that. Of course, I spent a lot of time at the boat club. I had a really, really, really tough year, actually. I had some really good coxes that I was trialing against. This guy Ed Boston coxed the boat race the year before, Sam Mazurkis, who ended up coxing the American Olympic team a few years later, so it was really, but it was because of that, it was such an opportunity for growth. My coach Steve Trapmore, he actually coached me at Imperial a few years prior, and then actually coaches us now in the national team. So the sort of Cambridge connection is definitely very like front of mind in my day to day now. But yeah, it's funny because it was only 1 year, but it's had such an impact on me. Since then, I've been involved with the boat club as a sort of coxing coach. Did it for a few years on my own, and now I kind of share the role with Ian Middleton, who's another cox at Cambridge for many years. So yeah, it was a really important time in my life, and I try and get back there whenever I can. My brother still lives there. He was a student there. So yeah, I use that as an excuse to try and get there. I mean, I like seeing him, but also it's nice to just be back in the place.
I'm fascinated by what you said there about competition in terms of the coxes, because I suppose from the outside looking in, it would appear relatively straightforward in terms of picking a boat because you've got the strongest, fastest rowers, and that's something that's measurable. Whereas maybe that's not quite as easily measurable for coxes. So I'm curious as to, you know, what goes into a decision-making process for, obviously in your case, selecting a cox for that year when it was particularly competitive, but, you know, in general, I'm sure it's really competitive for that GB8 as well.
Yeah, it's I've never had to select cox, so it's I've never been on the other side on the side of, you know, what am I going for here. But I think what I certainly try and keep it as simple as possible, and I'm just trying to make the boat go fast. But it's, I guess, from a rower's perspective, you're trying to, that's about like how strong you are and how well you can apply that power in the water. From a cox's perspective, I guess it's a little bit more potentially complex into like how you achieve making a boat go quick. I think you need to have a really clear picture in your mind about how you want people to apply themselves. You need to have the know-how to try and bring that picture in your mind to life with the rowers, and that's, I guess, a lot of that's wrapped up in communication, trust that you can build with them so that they'll follow what you're saying, and also I guess how you are in a competitive environment. And I think like you're kind of, at least the way I feel about it, is that you're constantly developing, you're constantly tweaking and changing to try and best suit the environment in the boat. And to a certain extent, you want that environment to kind of mold to you as well. There are things that you believe strongly that you're not willing to compromise on, but then other things, you know, like I'm always looking to evolve and get feedback from the crew and from the coach on what I'm doing, try and, you know, remove any sense of ego just to make sure I'm maximizing the opportunity to do the best for the guys at the time, but also they've got to do the best that they can for me, and go with what I'm saying. So, and I guess the kind of boring part is like, can you stay in shape? Can you stay light? So yeah, it is definitely complex, but it all comes down to like who makes the boat go quickest. And luckily I've been on the right side of that decision for a few years now, but you know, we'll see moving forward if I can stay there. That definitely nothing's given, but yeah, I think it's complex and simple at the same time.
Talk to me a little bit about the difference between coxing the boat race in 2013 and then going on to competitive senior action, where, you know, an Olympic regatta is you row 2 kilometers in a straight line, whereas everyone knows the boat race is very different on a much wider stretch of water, and, you know, much more, you know, there's much more steering involved and it's a longer course, etc. And I'm curious as to how that process was like adapting to that.
Yeah, it's they are very different races. I think, yeah, certainly with the boat race, the steering is a much bigger factor. In international racing, you're just trying to steer as straight as possible. And that is a challenge with, you know, people kind of managing their own, how much power they're putting down or crosswinds, etc. But in the boat race, it's like a vital role. You're always trying to put yourself in the best position and muscle someone else out of the best position. I think, let's see here. In the boat race, it's kind of that there's a sort of sense that, you know, I suppose you're always looking ahead. So you're kind of thinking, right, where am I at on the course now? Well, I know the next bend is worth this amount of distance if you're on the inside or the outside. So you're kind of constantly calculating, like maybe I'm like one seat down, but functionally that means I'm 3 seats up. So this is fine. Or actually this is really not fine and we're in a lot of danger. So whereas I guess in international racing, it's just like non-contact sport, A to B as fast as you can. What you see is what you get. So it's a lot, I say international racing is probably a lot more like fast and furious, a lot more simple, but maybe we could say a little bit more sterile. There's always been a part of me that wonders about going back to the kind of side by side on the river. And I think it is probably the most fun you can have in a rowing boat, and definitely any sort of opportunity for a bit of side by side action on the Thames, I'll always jump at.
And then what about your pathway from going from university racing to, you know, international racing, it's quite a well-trodden path between both Oxford and Cambridge boat clubs to international racing and even the Olympics. I mean, there was a really great picture of you and I can't remember her name, but a US athlete, I think, who also went to Homerton. So clearly there's quite a lot of CUBC athletes there. I'm wondering, you know, what was your pathway like to get to that stage post Cambridge?
Yeah, Olivia Coffey. Yeah, she's that's the one. Yeah, she's amazing. We're trying to get a photo, and then I imagined it was going to be a sort of socially distanced one. And she just grabbed me, and then they took a photo. I was thinking, oh no, I hope we don't get in trouble for this. But yeah, it's. I think her path is a lot more straightforward. She's probably like a lot better at university than I was at the time. But yeah, so I graduated, and then I was pulled into a sort of development project at GB, a sort of second eight. We raced through the summer, 2013, picked up a few wins at some less important races. It was a lot of fun. And then I kind of stepped into that, a sort of B boat in the national team. I coxed the Cox pair for a number of years, which was great. You still kind of compete for world championships and things like that. It's not an Olympic class event. So come 2016, there was never going to be a Cox pair, but it did mean that you could have two coxes in the national team at the same time. And I think that was really good. Because I was competing against someone who was much more experienced. So again, like a lot of a big opportunity for growth. And occasionally I got a chance in the eight, which was awesome. So I spent 3 years in that, and unfortunately for me, I didn't make the cut for Rhea. Got the had the conversation with Jürgen, the you're out conversation. It's always a difficult one. But I absolutely, like, you know, I respect his decision, and kind of only motivates you more to come back and make it the next time. So I took almost a year out, did a bit of coaching down at University of London, and then Phelan retired actually after Rio. So then when I came back, I was suddenly top dog and got in the eight and stayed there ever since. A bit of a tumultuous time. We had a lot of people retire, so we kind of were not so good in 2017, and then a bit better in 18, a bit better in 19, and kind of built from there. But it was definitely a long road, I probably wouldn't have it any other way. I think I learned as much as I could, so that was good.
And how easy or difficult, I mean, you're not going to say it's easy, but what's that process going to be like to try and retain your place for 2024?
Yeah, I think there are definitely a lot of young coxes out there that would love to step up. A lot of them I've coached personally, so I know how good they are, and they're good. I of course would back myself. Got a lot of experience, more experience than anyone else that's interested, I think. So I think, you know, got to be ready for a fight, ready for a challenge. But I think I will be ready to do just that. But, you know, I'd have big respect for it, for anyone else that wants to have a go. And again, I see it as a chance to get better, to learn as much as possible from that situation.
Thank you for listening to The Lion's Den. Make sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to follow the Bluebird on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram to keep up to date with the world of Cambridge sport.